So now we're on to the Acapulco Beach story with Murray Davidson in Skeena in 1936.
That's approximately it, and the date, as I say, is approximately it. And in that case, they lacked means of carrying large quantities of frozen goods and frozen meat, and of course there weren't the facilities abroad in places like Mexico to get them, so they ended up by replenishing their meat supply by buying beef on the hoof in Acapulco, which is a much smaller place then than it is now, driving it down to the beach and butchering it on the beach and taking the quarters off to the ship.
And perhaps some livestock.
And perhaps some live livestock.
Yes, some live livestock. Yes. So that
and then, and as a sort of corollary to this, it should be, I'd just like to recall that when the Venture was doing her first trip south to the West Indies, she broke her main boom in the Gulf Stream, and to give her navigability under sail, someone had to get to work and fish a spar, which is something not normally done in the modern Navy, but they got down and did it somehow using spare. We always carry at least one spare topmast.
Yes.
We probably use that to fish it.
Yeah. Okay, that shows the initiative and ingenuity of and the seamanship of these sailors pre-war.
Mm.
Then I said about the fact that I had lost the keys once when I was first officer of the day, and you had a similar experience with Miss Curtis, who worked for Captain Govro, S-O-I, in Halifax in 1939. She always took her holidays in August, so...
This is the situation. As the war clouds were developing, she, unfortunately or otherwise, decided that she could be spared. And anyway, she was given leave to go on her annual holiday down to a little place on the coast of Maine, which is not in touch by telephone with the rest of the world. And in the meantime, the Saguenay, which I was attached, was just finishing off having ASDIC fitted, and we were doubling up as cipher officers for the impending situation. And anyway, it came with us. They began to require more and more publications from CB publications to deal with the emergencies that were developing. But they could not find the keys to the CB locker, and no one knew where they'd been, where they'd been placed, but eventually it meant that someone on the staff down in Halifax had to get in his car and drive all the way down to this little place on the coast of Maine to find out where the keys were the keys were placed. And sure enough, they were in Halifax. They were in good, safe keeping, but nobody knew where they were. I think she was rather embarrassed about all that, but... no one ever mentioned it. I don't know. I take it that she's probably no longer...
Well, we could check that. There was then Lieutenant Commander Lay was there, and...
I'm trying to remember. Oh, yes.
Fitchnoys was there.
Fitchnoys was there.
That's all.
I'm trying to remember.
Govro and Gow.
No, Gow. Gow was the other one who was there. He was the boom defense officer there.
Yes, he was. Then you mentioned a story about Rooney Annesley, who in September 39... You relieved Pat Budge as torpedo officer, Gus Miles as your captain, but I've forgotten the ship.
Saguenay. I rejoined Saguenay, and Saguenay was detached about the beginning of October, I think it was, to go down to the West Indies as part of the patrol, keeping an eye on German ships trying to break out back to Germany.
Yes.
And one of their havens down there were the Dutch islands of Curacao and Aruba. Many of them had been bunkering in Venezuela and were trying to break back to the country. We also kept an eye on all the ships coming out of the Panama Canal.
Yes.
But in this case, of course, we had to get the maximum mileage, maximum economy out of our fuel because we had limited endurance anyway and we had to cover Long Beach. We were given a sort of water allowance of something like about 2 quarts a day, which we had to look after ourselves, plus an additional for cooking. But anyway, when we did our normal twice daily action station exercise, on these occasions, the engineer officer was going the rounds to checking into the damage control setup for which he was responsible.
Well, that was your brother Jack.
That was my brother Jack, yes. And he was came across the wardroom bathroom scuttle open with clouds of steam pouring out of it, and he wondered what had gone wrong. He thought it would have been an accident, but he put his head inside only to find then the sub-lieutenant Annesley reclining at length in the bath, a full tub of bath, playing his flute, which caused Brother Jack no end of concern, because there was probably a considerable amount of oil fuel represented by the water in that
yes, of course,
in that bathtub.
Well, I remember John Summers as engineer officer, in order to accentuate the fact that water was precious, if we wanted to scotch in water, he had to initial the chit. If it was a scotch and ginger ale, you could get it, but yeah. Scotch and water, no. You also mentioned that Rooney was navigator, but he preferred electrics.
Oh, he was, yes. His main interest in life was communications and electronics in general. And he certainly had a talent on looking after, handling and even developing electronic circuits, including communications and the ASDIC. And he was forever tinkering with them, trying to get them to work better or even repair them when they broke down. But somehow this had its detrimental effects on the navigation of the ship, because he would tend to forget things like noon sights and whatnot. So I remember being sent for one day when Rooney had sort of lost track of where the ship was, and the captain wanted to know where it was because he was trying to work out his endurance and how to cover the beat.
This was Gus Miles.
This was Gus Miles. And so he sent to me and said, find out where this ship is. And this left me with sort of a problem of, I could see the mountainous coastline about 20 miles away in two directions, but where the ship was, there's not much. And there's no question of checking by soundings and no banks.
No.
So I took a couple of sites to check, but of course that only gave me one position line on the thing. But that in conjunction with the general trend of the shoreline made me feel that we were much too far to the west. In other words, we were getting towards Columbia rather than towards...
You said you thought you were 20 miles away from where you were, and Gus Miles said...
He'd accept 10.
So you bargained.
So we bargained. Anyway, we turned around and went the other way.
Yeah.
And eventually got back.
Well,
And that gave me time to get another sight and another bearing to give me a fix.
Well, thank you for those stories, Jack. And that, I know, is all you've got time for this afternoon. But I hope we can make a future tape before I leave Ottawa or at some subsequent date, and at that time I would like you to go through your joining the Navy time up to the end of the war, chronologically as you remember it. Researchers can check Navy lists for names and places and latitudes and longitudes if you're not sure. If you would keep that in mind, I'm sure Alec Douglas would appreciate that, because he has similar stories and one jives with another or leads to a new line of research. So just for the purpose of this tape, what year did you join the Navy and where?
I joined the Navy in 1934, but prior to that I'd been at RMC. I joined RMC in 1932 as a preliminary. It was a recognized method of entry into the Navy.
Yes.
So that my first connection with the Navy as such was 1933, in the summer training period.
Yes.
A temporary acting probationary midshipman.
Yes, RCNVR, I think.
RCNVR,
yes. Yes, yes. Debbie Pierce was quite startled to find out that he had been in the RCNVR for 1 year.
And the following summer, of course, I went down as a temporary acting probationary sub-lieutenant,
yes.
RCNVR.
Yes.
At the end of which summer training, I was accepted into the
RCN. What two ships did you serve in those two summers training?
Well, the first summer, 1933, was mainly shore training, but we did go to sea in one of the coal-burning sweepers for two separate days. We were given a touch of how to trim a coal-fired boiler. And
yes.
There's a funny story, which, again, I think you want to verify somewhere, but in those days, we still had some hangover, still had some holdover World War I CNBR officers who were, they were trying to give them training to sort of watchkeeping level, so they go back to their divisions and take an active interest in the training of the personnel there. And one of these particular people was a lieutenant, I don't know what his, I think his real name was Hall, already. He's known as Tarry Briggs Hall.
Tarry Briggs?
No, Briggs. Tarry Briggs. No,
oh,
it's
Tarry Briggs
Hall. And he was being taken out to sea as one of the days that we were out in the coal-burning sweeper to do his navigation run, you see, and the lieutenant commander in command said, now look, I'll take you out of harbor and I'll give you a departure point, and I want you to take the ship out beyond the sight of the Sambro light vessel. And I said, I'll check you on that. And then I want you to bring it back, set your course to get you back, yourself back into Halifax on the basis that you can't see the the approach points, but you've got to do it on DR. So all went well, and we were down, you know, we're doing our little bit of stint down below. Anyway, we all came on deck for lunch, and this chap had obviously got out to the far end of the run and turned around and coming back, and the captain was sitting in his, he had a little bunk sit behind the wheel in the wheelhouse. He was down there on the reserve lieutenant was up top, and we were sitting around on deck with our box luncheons, and suddenly this old ship came to a stop. We couldn't quite see what had happened, but anyway, the captain was wondering what the hell was going on, so he bounced up on deck just in time to hear old Tarry Briggs Hall lean over the side of the ship to a fishing boat, which way to Halifax?
Just tell me, who were your term mates at RMC that went into the Navy?
I was the only one.
You were the only one.
I fitted in the early years that this was done. Debbie Pierce went in first year, 32.
Debbie Pierce, 32, yeah.
My brother, Harry Winnett, and Larry Rutherford in 33.
Yeah.
I went in 34.
Where's Bill Landymore?
Oh, he comes a couple of years later.
Yeah.
The engineer. Not Foster. Foster.
What?
Foster was...
spell it?
F-O-R-S-T-E-R.
Foster, yeah.
He went in 35, and then you get into the period. I just can't keep
no, well,
there was Charles Landymore, and I think a third went in the following.
Mickey year. Sterling.
Mickey
no.
Sterling went with... No, Mickey no. wasn't RMC. He was the same year...
Scruffy O'Brien.
Scruffy O'Brien was the third one.
Yeah. So that'll be the takeoff point when we make our next tape. And thank you very much. Unborn generations of naval officers will thank you.
Well, they'll probably wonder who...
We must also note now, for reference later, that... In 1937, you served in Royal Oak, which was torpedoed later in Scapa Flow. And you served in Ottawa as XO before relieved by Tommy Pullen. And then you served in Athabasca in 1943. Just before she was hit by the buzz bomb, and certainly before she was torpedoed off the French coast later. You have mentioned to me that in interviewing Admiral de Wolf, I might mention the Arandora Star, A-R-A-N-D-O-R-A Star. And perhaps he'd like to talk about a book called... quote, call it a lie, unquote, about the internees, coming from the UK, the prisoners coming from the UK to Canada when Arandora Star was torpedoed. Anyway, period. That's the end of that. This is an interview with Rear Admiral R. W. Timbrell, T-I-M-B-R-E-L-L, in Ottawa on the 5th of June, 1982. Thank you for inviting me over to your lovely place this afternoon, Bob. We've talked about where we would start, and so you please will tell me about when you joined the Navy and why.
Well, hell, we go back to West Vancouver, 1935, when money was a bit tight. My stepfather was out of work. And in came to Vancouver those days, the White Empresses, the Empress of Canada, the Empress of Japan. And up the street from us lived one Ronnie Jackson, later Commander Jackson, Captain Jackson, who was running our West Vancouver ferries. And through Ronnie's advice and influence and the desire eventually to be on the bridge of one of those Empress ships, and the fact that because I'd been born in England, my father was English, and we'd returned to England at the end of World War I, there had been some money left to the family which I could use in England only for my education. And through those procedures and factors, I proceeded to join the HMS Conway, a cadet training ship located in Liverpool, United Kingdom. Arrived there September 1935.
Age?
15 years of age. With still the objective in mind to be on the bridge of a Canadian Pacific ship, namely the Merchant Service. 1 year passed. It was a very interesting year for a raw Canadian to go over and join the English school system, which you know well, put up with. Instead of the cane, we had a teaser, so anytime you didn't move quickly enough or sweep the deck properly or lash your hammock up in the 1 minute and 32 seconds, you got a stroke across your bottom, up to a maximum of 12. I recall that was not as difficult to live with as at the end of it, to stand up at attention and look at this young English squirt and shove your hand out and say, "Thank you, sir. That really hurt."
Another cadet?
Another cadet.
A senior cadet, yeah.
And an English squirt, and I'd never forgotten that term. But later, of course, when one became a cadet captain, one saw the pleasures of life coming back. 1 year went by. Survived. I can't really say it was the finest, most enjoyable chapter in my life. I often used to analyze that somehow I was a late starter in life. I enjoyed life more than I seemed to apply to it. And it wasn't until I reached the rank of Rear Admiral I realized that there was a career in it for me. So one considers a late starter. Nevertheless, back to Conway. 1 year there, then suddenly my parents heard that the Canadian Navy had opened the gates to recruiting. And through friends of my mother's here in Ottawa, I got the message to report down to Portsmouth, which ended up being interviewed by then one Commander Leonard Murray, Royal Canadian Navy, who was commander of the Iron Duke. And we had a delightful lunch. I had a tour of the Iron Duke, and taken back to the railway station, and later to be advised I was accepted for the Royal Canadian Navy, which still meant completing certain other things, such as medicals, which I did in London at Admiralty.
Either you said it and I missed it. What year is this?
1936.
36, and Len Murray, later Admiral Len Murray, was what of the Iron Duke?
The commander.
He was the
executive officer.
All right, thank you.
And so I go back to Conway for my second year. It's a two-year course, and I enter the naval class to join the Royal Canadian Navy in
August 1937. With 9 other cadets, my term was a large term, the 1937 term. There were 10 of us. There was O'Brien, Frewer, McDowell, Porter, who was later killed in the St. Croix.
Well, what's his first name?
Tim Porter.
Tim, yeah.
From Vancouver Island. There was Freddie Frewer. There was Savard, Paul Clement Savard from Quebec.
Yeah.
Dudley Elcock, paymaster. Peter Cazette, paymaster. And another paymaster called Eden, E-D-E-N, who was killed at the Battle of River Plate. And, of course, myself, all 10 of us.
Yeah.
We joined Erebus September 1937.
After your second year at Conway was finished.
Right.
Yeah.
And the 10 of us joined along with a large group of English cadets called Public School Entry.
Yes.
As the Dartmouth cadets went straight to another ship which we later joined. And there, one met the CO of the Erebus, Commander Fanshawe, Royal Navy. Fanshawe was unique. He had no liking for anyone from then the colonies or the Commonwealth. And one morning, we were all lined up in the corner deck, and he advised us that he had written a letter to their lordships recommending that we all be fired from the Navy as being unsuitable officer-like material. My mother in West Vancouver, many miles to the west, received a copy of that letter and, of course, was rather intrigued by the term and rather queried as to what their term the lordship applied to. Did one look up to the heavens or not? Because she certainly had no knowledge. Nevertheless, she was worried that her young son was going to be returned shortly with a kit bag and rather new clothing, unused. Instead, we stayed and Fanshawe went. And he entered to the mental home somewhere up the east coast of the United Kingdom to finish his days. The rest of us stayed in the Navy and ended up, as you know. We then were there till after Christmas, and then in January, the 10 of us went off to join HMS Vindictive, which was a seagoing cadet training ship.
Yes.
Two cruises, one to the West Indies, and one to the Baltic. The West Indies cruise, nothing I can recall, but the Baltic cruise was interfered with in the sense that half cadets came down with German measles en route from Helsinki to Copenhagen. And of course, we were looking forward to Copenhagen, having been told all about the attractive blonde girls, and we would moor alongside the main street, and everything was right ready for us, with girls in the putting their heads in the portholes. Unfortunately, we never saw Copenhagen. We went to a more attractive Scottish port called Invergordon. And instead of long Danish girls, we saw white Scottish sheep. No more comment.
Not on sheep, no.
So we finished Vindictive, and then we split up as we graduated to the great rank of midshipman. And we went to our respective battleships and cruisers for our 2 years midshipman time. I went to the Mediterranean. I had asked for the Med, and I joined HMS Barham, Beery Barham, in September 38. Our captain was an interesting old joker. He had a high voice. He was short, and one day one can see the group of us standing on being called, cleared lower decks, all to the forecastle. And the captain said, "I understand whenever we play football, soccer, or rugger, the teams are cheered on by Up the Beeries. I would like it to be known from now on that we are not Beery, the Beery Barons." We played worse by that afternoon, and of course from there on we were called the Milksops. Until later we got a new captain, Hookie Walker by name, who lost one hand at Zeebrugge in 1915-16, when it was. And he let it be known that he rather enjoyed the term, Beery Barham, and so we returned to that wonderful spirit. But there, in Grand Harbor, 1938, behind The battle wagon line was Sussex, and aboard HMS Sussex was one then Thomas Charles Pullen, midshipman, one Robert Murdoch, midshipman. They were 1 year at least ahead of me. So they were old midshipmen.
You're in Valletta, in Malta.
That's right.
Yeah.
And after a year in Barum, going through the various crises, the Munich crisis, where every time there was a crisis in Europe, the Mediterranean fleet would move to Alexandria, which was our war station. And another time, we went to, when the crisis was over, I can see us in Naples, here the battleship. The captain, Hooky Walker, was to call on the senior person in Naples, the Prince of Piedmont.
Spell it, please.
Prince of Piedmont, P-I-E-D-M-O-N-T.
Yeah.
And he was royal blood. The captain got correctly dressed in swords and medals. I was ordered to go along as his aide, as a midshipman, so I put on my dirk and my bum freezer, the jacket we all had with lots of buttons. And
three buttons on the sleeve?
Three buttons on the sleeve and 12 on the breast. So we embarked in an Italian staff car, went up to the palace. We come inside the main entrance. We're met by his secretary into many gorgeous rooms. When finally out came the personal secretary of the prince, who insisted before we were to meet the prince, we had to take our swords off as they were considered weapons. And you know what amount of damage a dirk could do, apart from drawing blood on other midshipmen's bums in the shower rooms. So we left our swords and dirks, we went in to meet the Prince of Piedmont, and life went on. War broke out, 1939, and there was that little hesitation, as you remember, those of us who are Canadians, with the Royal Navy. There was a period of about 10 days when Canada was not at war with Germany. But in a good British spirit, that was quickly overlooked, because in those days we did not have Canada flashes on our shoulders, though I admit we had Canada on our buttons. Mm-hmm. But it took a sharp eye and a telescope to tell the difference. Barum sailed from the Mediterranean, and it's interesting how the cycle of life catches up with you. With Barum, we had 6 D-class destroyers that had been out in the Mediterranean. As we left Gibraltar, we were bound for the United Kingdom when the orders came through to divert and go to the Battle of the River Plate, as the Grasse Bay had been holed up and Admiralty diverted more forces in case the cruisers couldn't handle her. And as you know what happened, she came out and blew herself up, and we never got that. In fact, we didn't even get as far as the equator. When we altered course again for Halifax, where we joined the 1st Canadian Troop Convoy, TC-1, and escorted TC-1, as a fear then that there were a number of German battleships ready to run and intercept the 1st Canadian Troop, which was a large troop convoy and a valuable target. As we arrived in the Clyde, Scotland, a dark night, pitch black, no radar in those days.
No.
The destroyers were ahead of us, and we were leading the convoy into the Clyde. The last turn, as you come up, you were called to port. The signal went out by flashing light, the famous blue shaded light, and on our port bow was the HMS Duchess. 5 destroyers and Barum altered to port, and the Duchess altered to starboard and went right across our bows. And Barum was fitted with a ram bow of 1914-15 design. We hit the Duchess, rolled her over. She swung up on her keel up and swung alongside. This was again 1:30 in the morning.
Keel?
Just to remember the time, 1:30 in the morning.
Keel up?
Yes. When I came on, I came off watch at midnight. We were sleeping in our hammocks, the midshipman's flat, under the quarterdeck. As we scrambled up the ladder, looking over the side, on the starboard side, I saw my first ASDIC dome, two destroyer propellers slowly turning, and a rudder. Suddenly the ship heaved by the bow, came up, and a number of portholes opened. And heads came out, human heads popped their heads out, and of course called out to get them out. In those days our destroyers were not fitted with any escape hatches. There was no way you could get out a destroyer hatch. It was too small, you could get your head out, but you couldn't get your shoulders out. The other factor was in those days, and it continued for a fair time into the war, all destroyers kept 10 depth charges on the rails and the throwers set to 50 feet.
Yes.
And this was for the emergency attack, as we called it in those days.
Yes.
So the captain of the Barham, again Hooky Walker, was very worried about if the stern of the Dutchess sank to 30 feet, which was sufficient then to detonate the charges.
Yes.
The charges would countermine and then would sink the Barham.